Welcome, everyone, to the Mona Charon Show. Thanks so much for joining me. I am delighted to welcome my friend Jonathan Rauch today for a timely discussion of corruption. John, thank you so much for joining me. I forgot to say you write for The Atlantic and you are an author of a number of excellent books, which I have learned so much from and touted endlessly.
And a senior fellow at Brookings.
And a senior fellow at Brookings. There we go. Okay, we've got your whole CV. You wrote a piece back in February that was one of the more important pieces, I think, that has been written in the second Trump era. And you set out to describe what we're in. And I'm going to let you spell that out for our listeners. What kind of a regime are we in?
The word for it, a multisyllabic nightmare, is patrimonialism. So the genesis of this article is that we have been trying to figure out for a long time, is Trump an authoritarian? Well, he seems awfully disorganized if he's an authoritarian, and he doesn't seem all that interested in some of the authoritarian hallmarks. He's certainly some kind of populist, illiberal populist, but we were trying to figure out, so what is this we were seeing? Because it's, on the one hand, extremely familiar, and on the other hand, didn't fit our standard 20th century boxes. That problem was solved for me by a book published middle of last year by a couple of political scientists named Steve Hansen and forget the first name, but Kopstein is the second. It's called The Assault on the State. And they draw on the work of the famous early 20th century sociologist Max Weber. And he said that before you had modern democracies and modern countries with their big bureaucratic expert governments, the standard form of government was patrimonialism. Weber called it that because patrimonialism gets its legitimacy not from elections, for example, but from the head of the state being kind of the symbolic father of the country. But what Weber noticed about patrimonialism is its defining element is that its principle is that the government, the state, is the personal property or family business of the head of state.
So aren't all monarchies that?
Most monarchies are. There are constitutional monarchies. But what Weber and other political scientists noticed is that this system was the standard for pretty much most of human history. People didn't distinguish between the public sector and the private sector. The government just belonged, and the country belonged, to the person in charge. Okay, well, what's so interesting about that and Donald Trump? It has a couple of implications. First of all, the opposite of authoritarianism is liberal democracy, but the opposite of patrimonialism is bureaucracy. Patrimonialism is not a theory of government. Instead, it's a system of loyalty, which you can layer on top of a democracy, at least for a while, or on top of a monarchy, or for that matter, it's the organizing principle used in gangs, organized crime, the mafia, for example. Even cults use this form of organization where the leader basically owns everything. So the opposite of patrimonialism is bureaucracy, because patrimonialism says everyone is personally loyal to the boss. It's about personal loyalty. Classic authoritarianism, the stuff that, for example, Hitler did and Stalin did and the other great 20th century authoritarians did, they built these gigantic state bureaucratic machines of oppression. That's what's so scary in Orwell's 1984. They intended to build institutions that would outlive them and oppress the country for decades, if not centuries. Patrimonialism doesn't really care so much about that. Instead, it just goes through the existing bureaucracy. It fires all the people who it suspects of disloyalty, and it replaces them with people who it thinks will be loyal to the president and his family. Or sometimes they just put the family in there. So they just kind of layer this loyalty on top of the existing system of government.
That's interesting, but I want to dig a little bit into this, because some of the classic authoritarian or even totalitarian regimes that we're all so familiar with from the 20th century also had strong elements of this. I mean, you know, you had the cult of personality around Stalin, and the very nature of Hitler's regime was personal loyalty. Heil Hitler. They didn't say Heil Third Reich. It was all about the personality of the leader. So is there really a sharp demarcation between...
Oh, well, no, there's never a sharp demarcation. You know, these you can get really hung up trying to put things in boxes and yeah. label this and that. And one of the things you've got to realize about patrimonialism is once it's been in place for a while, the people who are running it realize if they want to hand it off to their children and grandchildren, they need to institutionalize it. So they begin converting the patrimonial regime to an authoritarian regime. Okay. That's what you see Putin, for example. He starts out as a patrimonialist. He leaves the capitalist system in place, most of the pre-existing institutions, but he makes sure that anyone who is not loyal to him has a tragic accident falling out a window. Then the Ukraine war comes and he realizes he needs a full-blown authoritarian state and creates one. So patrimonialism, left to its own devices, often will try to turn into classic authoritarianism. So it's a mistake to try to completely separate them, but it helps understand what Trump is up to right now.
Yeah. So talk about the bureaucracy angle a little bit more, if you would. So you say the bureaucracy is the enemy of patrimonialism and independent experts, that sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly. So the interesting question from a political theory point of view is, well, why did patrimonialism ever die out? It's the most familiar form of government. And the answer is, starting in the second half of the 19th century with Bismarck's Germany, building a modern state required tremendous expertise. Running, in particular, a modern military with the millions of personnel and the procurement, and running a modern economy, that was just beyond the ability of a bunch of cronies of the person in charge who were basically there to funnel money and political benefits to the ruling family. They just couldn't do it. Mm. And that's why you get the switch toward modernity, which pits these big democratic modern bureaucracies against the big communist and Nazi, et cetera, bureaucracies. What we see now in countries around the world, it's not just in the U.S., it's also Modi's India. We see this in Hungary, in Slovakia, in the Philippines. One can go on. What we see is a global resurgence of patrimonialism in lots of countries.
You say in your piece, and by the way, I love this Italian expression that you use more than once. It's just the Italian, it just rolls off the tongue. The capo di tutti capi, the boss of bosses.
Yes, that's from Hansen and Kopstein.
Yeah.
If you want a good understanding of patrimonialism, the first scene of The Godfather, the first movie, mm-hmm. is dead on. Why'd you go to the police?
Yeah, you should have come to me. Spell it out for people who maybe are a little younger and haven't seen the movie or don't remember it that vividly.
So in the first scene, an Italian-American's come to the godfather, Don Corleone, asking for his help. His daughter has been, I think, raped and assaulted. The police haven't done much about it. And he comes to Don Corleone and says, I need revenge. And Don Corleone's reaction is, why should I help you now? You've been going to the police instead of to me. You haven't been my friend. If you want me to help you, you have to be my friend. And in the scene, the supplicant kisses the ring, personal loyalty. I'm now your man. And in exchange for that personal loyalty, Don Corleone agrees to do this act of vengeance. And that's kind of it in a nutshell. law enforcement in a patrimonial state is an exchange of favors.
Yes, and we have so much in the news right now. As we're recording this, Trump has issued a full pardon to a sheriff who was convicted, a Virginia sheriff who was convicted of selling favors from his office. They had him on videotape exchanging cash for government sinecures. And he was convicted, sentenced to, I think, 10 years. But he is a big Trump booster, big MAGA guy. And so Trump pardoned him, gave him a full and unconditional pardon. So there it is. These stories just keep coming all the time because what you wrote is just so true. Okay. And you also say, I'm just going to quote like this, you say regarding why bureaucracies are a threat. You say people with expertise, experience, and distinguished resumes are likewise suspect because they bring independent standing and authority. So patrimonialism stocks the government with non-entities and hacks, or when possible, it bypasses bureaucratic procedures altogether. Okay, so that sure looks like a very good description of what Trump is attempting to do. He has systematically attempted to hamstring any ethics offices in the government, the inspectors general, government ethics offices. He has fired people. He has fired Justice Department lawyers who committed the sin of simply doing their jobs and prosecuting him, or the January 6th defendants. So this is all patrimonialism. It's pretty horrifying. It is exactly the opposite of the rule of law that we all thought we had in this country and that we did have in this country. So tell us what you think the Achilles heel is of this kind of a system.
I mentioned the interesting question of why patrimonialism ever died out. And that's because it can't run a modern state. Why can't it run a modern state? There are two fundamental and inherent problems with patrimonialism. The first is incompetence. You don't want people in the bureaucracy, in the government, with independent standing and expertise. Those people are a threat to your power. They may try to stand up to you. They may cite evidence that you don't want to hear. They may have independent standing in the community. So you get rid of those people. And we saw that. We saw Doge doing firings of people. Trump fires people who are not personally loyal. He's been through the Justice Department. He started on the military and so forth. The problem with that is you're going to lose the experts that you need to run a modern government. And this becomes pretty evident over time. It's hard for a government over time to hide incompetence if airplanes are falling out of the sky, for example, or health systems aren't working. Or the weather is not being properly reported. There's a second Achilles heel, and that's corruption. Patrimonialism is everywhere and always corrupt. In fact, by definition, corruption, as we think of it in a liberal democracy, is the use of public power for private gain. And gain can, of course, mean pecuniary gain, money in your pocket, but can also mean political gain. That's what Nixon did in Watergate. Either way, under patrimonialism, there's no distinction between what belongs to the person running the government and what belongs to the people. It's all just one thing. And Trump believes he basically owns whatever comes in the door. A donation of a plane to be Air Force One, that will belong to him. Because why shouldn't it?
Mm-hmm.
This means, by definition, this patrimonial system mixes public and private and is just rife with corruption. And it turns out, when you look at how patrimonialism and its related systems have been successfully resisted over the past 100-plus years, it's been by exploiting that Achilles heel of of corruption. You can go back to the American Progressive Movement, late 19th and early 20th century. What did they harp on? The corruption of the political machines. And they had plenty to work with. Something as modern as 2 years ago, the Law and Justice Party, which was a patrimonialist party in Poland, was kicked out of power pretty much entirely on a corruption issue. Ukraine, how did the Ukrainians get rid of the corrupt Russian Todian government? They mobilized the corruption issue. You can look at it more recently in this country, for example, the campaign that Newt Gingrich used to launch the Republican Revolution by unseating House Speaker Jim Wright. What did he harp on? Most corrupt speaker ever. Corruption is easy for people to understand, and they don't like it. And it drives a wedge between the patrimonialist who claims to really speak for the country and the little guy, I am your guy. It drives a wedge between them once people see that, no, what he's really interested in is himself and his family. But you have to run a campaign around it.
It can be a stake in the heart of the whole populist argument, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He goes right to the heart of the argument.
Yeah.
That's why, you know, Putin, the person who most endangered Vladimir Putin was
Alexei Navalny.
First name?
Alexei
Navalny. And what was his campaign? He focused like a laser on Putin's corruption. He wound up dead as a result.
Yeah.
But Putin was right to be very scared of that.
Yeah. He used to, working with Bellingcat, he used to post videos of Putin's palaces and yachts and the way he was personally profiting. And that's... that's very, very effective. By the way, Jim Wright, I remember Newt Gingrich's campaign against Jim Wright. Jim Wright, was slightly corrupt. He wasn't even all that corrupt, but it was a very effective tool in Gingrich's arrow in his quiver. This president is corrupt on a scale that really makes all those other corrupt people, except Putin, look like pikers, right? I mean, this is on a level, this whole meme coin thing that he's doing, where he just invites everybody and anybody around the world to put money in his pocket by purchasing these meme coins. That is unheard of, unprecedented. I don't think Viktor Orban or any of the others, except for Putin, has dared to do anything on that scale. Accepting that jet from Qatar does reflect a level of his sense of impunity, right? That he really can do anything and be as corrupt as he likes and will not pay a price for it. So what I want to challenge you with is this. Is he right? I mean, there is a way in which Trump has always escaped whipping for his corruption by doing it out in the open. And there seems to be something that people just cannot wrap their heads around, the idea that if he's doing it out in the open, it's still wrong, right? They think it must be, it must be okay because he's not hiding it. How do you get around that?
Well, okay. So a few things we should talk about here, Mona. One is the two best arguments that Trump is immune to anti-corruption. One is that people think all politicians are corrupt anyway, and he's no different.
Yeah.
And the other is that people, it's what you just said, people have already priced it in. They know he's corrupt. They've decided they don't mind. Or they think, well, he's such a rich guy, he doesn't need to be corrupt, so he can accept Qatari planes, but it won't affect his decision making.
Right.
So those things are certainly true to some extent. But why are they true to some extent? I think part of the answer He said, for the last 8 or 9 years, Trump's opponents in the Democratic Party and the Republican Party and elsewhere have allowed themselves to run hither and yon, chasing whatever appears to be the scandal of the day, the outrage of the day, the tweet of the day, the decision of the day. You know, trade tariffs go up, tariffs go down. He sends out a crazy tweet. There's a fracas in the Oval Office involving Ukraine. Then there's a conspiracy theory in the Oval Office involving South Africa. And we all just run around and react. What the opposition has never tried to do, or at least I think never succeeded in doing, is what the Civic Platform Party, for example, did in Poland, or for that matter, what Gingrich did against right, which is a coherent, relentless messaging campaign around Trump's being the most corrupt president ever. And that means instead of constantly playing defense about whatever is the story of the day so that he's allowed to do a confuse-a-thon where there's so many corruption stories people can't even keep track, it means that you organize your messaging around the primary theme, most corrupt ever. And that means when you talk about Trump, you call him the corrupt, you call it the corrupt Trump administration. You make it his middle name. You fit a lot of the other things that are going on into the net master narrative of corruption. Why is he doing these trade deals? Because he's using them as a form of graft. Why is he cutting taxes $3 trillion? I can't remember the figure, but $3 trillion or whatever it is for the rich. Well, that's going to not only help him politically, it's going to starve Social Security of the funds that it needs to be solvent. It turns out the numbers work out that way. But all of these things that he's doing, or at least many of them, can be fitted into this master narrative of corruption. And I don't think that's been tried. It is true that there is a MAGA base, as we both well know, that is never going to give up allegiance to. But those aren't the people that are needed to drive him and MAGA out of office. The people who can drive him out of office are the ones he loses once his approvals are in the mid-30s and stay there. The people who think, well, wait a minute, prices are going up, and maybe that's because he's corrupt. Maybe it's because of these corrupt deals he's making. He's not for me, he's for himself, and so forth.
So again, playing devil's advocate, you say that the incompetence will demonstrate itself, that the opposition doesn't need to draw attention to the incompetence. If airplanes are falling out of the sky, as you said, or if babies are getting sick because they're not allowed to get vaccines, people don't need to be told who's responsible for that. They will know, whereas the corruption you need to keep hammering away at. Some people might say, well, no, you need to point out that the incompetence is because of this administration's decisions and the people, the complete hacks and morons that it has put in positions of authority, and that people need to know that to make decisions. What's your reaction to that?
I think I'm making a subtly, but perhaps importantly, different point, though you tell me. Of course you point out the incompetence. Of course you point out all sorts of things, the foreign policy setbacks, you know, the claims that he was going to solve Ukraine overnight, the claims that he was going to sort out the Middle East overnight. There's all kinds of things to work with there, and you should talk about them. But what I'm suggesting is that those can be fit within an umbrella narrative, a master narrative of corruption. Why is the government incompetent? Because the most corrupt president ever is going through it, turning it into a personal graft machine. So that's the claim, is that you can, with that master narrative, you can organize these other things in a way that will reach those critical voters. Is that plausible?
It's more than plausible. I mean, I think one thing that we've learned is that from Trump, honestly, is that, you know, the messaging that he uses, where he just repeats and repeats and repeats an idea a zillion times. And smart people roll their eyes. Oh, I wouldn't even say smart people. I'd say people whose job it is to pay attention to the news roll their eyes and say, can you believe that he's saying this again? But the fact is, most people are not paying close attention. And so when something is repeated 1,000 times, it does break through and they hear it. And people have there. It's been demonstrated that there. I forget. It's one of the biases that Tversky and Hahnemann discovered, which is I forget what it's called, but it's like when the first thing, the first fact that you hear about something is one you tend to believe, even if it turns out not to be right. And so if Trump is the first one to introduce an idea, you know, the immigrants are criminals and you didn't know anything about, you know, then you're going to be inclined to believe that even if later information would correct it.
That's such an important point, Mona. When I have this conversation with people like us, you know, kind of in the pro-democracy community and people with advanced degrees from elite universities, which I plead guilty to, they'll often say something like, well, but, you know, the money from this, the shakedown of the law firms, which is classic corruption, you know, if some governor said, from now on, if you want to represent the state or do business in a state courthouse, you have to donate to a fund that I control. That's obvious extortion, right? That's racketeering. It's blatantly corrupt.
Yeah,
but they will say something like, well, that fund isn't going into his personal pocket. It's instead a fund that's going to be used by him for other things. And I want to shake them by a little pulse and say, you're thinking like a lawyer. We need to think like propagandists. I use that in the best sense of the term, not the worst. I don't mean that you're lying to people or manipulating people. But I mean, this is about driving a message. It's not about crossing all the T's and dotting all the I's. It's about relentless, repetitive, focused, targeted messaging, not allowing the other side to change the subject. And when you want to pivot to something, doing it within your narrative. This is something that Trump is a master at. He is the best propagandist since certain people with German names that I will not mention in this context, but you know who I mean. He's really that good at driving a narrative, hammering it home, changing the subject. When it goes somewhere he doesn't like, he promulgates an outrage and then everyone chases that. We need to channel our inner propagandists. That's hard to do if you're thinking you need to build a case. Some people are starting to get it. Senator Chris Murphy, a couple months ago, went onto the Senate floor. He had a whole chart. He listed the corruption in Trump's first, I don't know what it was, 90 days or something. Senator Warren did something similar a little bit after. That's on the right track. But here's the thing. It can't be a speech by a senator followed by a long silence, followed by another speech by another senator. It needs to be senator after senator trooping to the Senate floor day after day.
Well, and trooping to the studios of, you know, TV studios and other places, podcasts. Yes, they can all come here. You're welcome. And to repeat something that we said before, but we glossed over it kind of quickly, but it's worth, you know, underlining it with black ink. This does undermine one of Trump's main appeals, namely that he is a populist, that he is for the people. By the way, this for the people thing, I mean, it always has sent a chill down my spine, since that language is always used by autocrats to justify trampling human rights, right? It's that they are the legitimate, the will of the people, right? It is the most, it's the clearest form. It's classic tyranny talk, right? Is that you can do anything to anybody in the name of what's, you know, good for the greater good.
They came out and said, I think it was Stephen Miller, the court should not interfere with us because we represent the will of the people.
Exactly. The will of the people. I always feel that he needs a German accent to be truly himself. But a Russian one would do just as well. But anyway, the point being, that populism is Trump's calling card. It gives him legitimacy. People think he, I remember in 2016, they started calling him the people's billionaire. It was even doubtful, by the way, at the time that he was even a billionaire, but it doesn't matter. He sure is one now. And the idea that he speaks for the less fortunate, and boy, you know, you just keep hammering home how much they are lining their own pockets. He, his family, his cronies, just before we started recording, Paul, a fellow named Paul Walczak, this news came out. He is a corrupt nursing home administrator who was convicted of tax evasion. He withheld taxes for his employees and then spent it on yachts and high living for himself, millions of dollars. But his mother is a big Trump fundraiser. And so he was given a full and complete pardon.
This just happened?
This just happened.
So you've got like your producer handing you these things as they come over the transom on this call?
I did it all by myself. I found it before we went on the air. Paul Walczak. Yeah. I mean, so just, you know, this ought to be, needs to be front and center. They are for themselves. They are lining their pockets.
You.
They're not for you. They're for themselves. And you're right. I mean, the tax cut issue can play into that. I mean, tax cuts.
Higher prices play into
higher
it.
Higher prices, yeah.
Eggs are expensive because of his corrupt deal making.
I don't know about that one. I don't know. I mean,
Mona, the point here
don't, oh, you're
is not
me.
To produce the the econometric survey.
Okay. Well, all right. But yeah, I do think it's a very good theme, and it has the advantage of being true. So it isn't as if we're trying to create, you know, a false narrative, which is what they do. You know, that, we've been robbed by all of our allies all these years. We've been chumps. We are being invaded by aliens who are committing, you know, horrible, rampant crimes, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Almost everything that they say is false. And what we are saying in response is true. Corruption
well, yeah,
is his
that's
middle
right.
name.
If I were a cynic, I'd say this might be effective if we were lying and exaggerating, but we don't need to. You know, Hillary Clinton, they successfully drove an anti-corruption campaign that I believe tanked Hillary Clinton in 2016. Trump called her corrupt Hillary, mm-hmm. and the entire Republican media establishment and political establishment swung into line behind that, driving a narrative that she was corrupt because of, what was it, 30 emails that were on the wrong server?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Now,
It wasn't just that. I mean, it was also the Clinton Foundation, all things, by the way, that pale in comparison to what Trump does.
Yeah.
But
you can add them up. In fact, the Clinton, none of them were well-grounded in any serious major corruption at all. I did a deep dive on the Clinton Foundation. They're on the level. They're a serious foundation and probably saved millions of lives because of vaccinations in Africa. This email server thing was a procedural violation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But the point is, you don't need to have the most brilliant material in the world to work with if you and your spokespeople and your media organizations can drive that narrative. But in this case, boy, do we have it. And I also think, tell me if you think this is naive. The stuff that's easiest to understand is the money in his pocket. But the bigger form of corruption that he's doing is the political corruption. That is, he's using the state, the power of government, to reward his friends and punish his enemies. And that's inherently and deeply corrupt. We, you and I, and our friends, in very good faith, have been talking about the rule of law, the Constitution, the integrity of our justice system, And none of that's gotten much traction with ordinary people. I think we should frame that as corruption because it is corruption. And I think in Watergate, the country showed that people can understand that the use of government agencies for personal political gain is also a form of corruption.
You know, I'm no expert on, political rhetoric or the best way to frame something for a campaign. But I think people respond, all people, high, low, educated, uneducated. I think we all have an internal sense of wanting justice as fairness, wanting things to be fair and resenting when they're not fair. And so if you can point out that it is unfair that somebody who was, you know, a Trump crony or a Trump donor and got pardoned, whereas somebody else didn't in the same position, you know, who wasn't a Trump donor, or, you know, frame it in terms of the unfairness of it. You know, I think that's a big part, for example, of the resistance to trans athletes, is that, you know, people, they don't like the idea of an unfair advantage. And, you know, there's no protest about trans, how do I put this? I always get the thing wrong. So about, let me put it this way. There's no protest when natal girls, so I guess they become trans men, want to compete in men's sports, as some do, right? Because nobody feels like, well, that's not fair to the men, right? Whereas when it goes the other way, there is an unfairness. Men are bigger, stronger, more blood, bigger hearts, etc. So I don't know. I just think the fairness element here is a powerful one. What do you think?
It may be. I think there's a variety of reasons why corruption has historically been the major liability of patrimonialist regimes. I don't doubt that that's one of them. Another way to talk about fairness is, you know, a lot of people, whites in particular, feel that others are cutting in line ahead of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, affirmative action and DEI and all of that. And they're not entirely wrong about that.
And immigration.
And yeah. They're not entirely wrong about that.
Right.
So here comes this administration where you can buy your way to the front of the line.
Yeah, exactly.
So but the broad point is, I'm not a political genius, and you probably aren't either, though I'm sure you're better at it than I am.
No.
But this isn't rocket science. This is about understanding this Achilles heel of patrimonialism and using it as an organizing theme. And then you go out there with it and you find out what works.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that Newt Gingrich originally knew that he could take down a Speaker of the House by focusing on the fact that some people were buying the Speaker of the House's book.
Yep.
Yeah. But he went after it. He went after a bunch of different things. He talked to every journalist that he could. He gave speeches on the House floor. He demanded investigations. He put in tickets, you know, with the House Ethics Committee demanding investigations of that and everything else he could find. And then he waited to see what stuck.
Okay, so one more possible pitfall here. We are in a moment in this country where people are so polarized that they cannot, it's crossed their eyes. They can't think straight about anything. They go immediately to whataboutism. And so if you point out corruption by this administration, they're going to say, yeah, but what about, you know, the House of Representatives, engages in insider trading. They refuse to ban it. Or, you know, the Democrats have done, you know, look at what Joe Biden did. He pardoned his entire family. He pardoned his corrupt son. They're going to say everybody does it. And so it's going to lose its power. What do you say to that argument?
I notice, by the way, that we have an audience, a new attendee. who seems to have fallen sound asleep.
And, you know, he probably speaks for some of our listeners. What can I say?
Oh, no, Mona, we're riveting. I'd say, sure, some people are going to say that, and some people are going to think that. And it is not adequate for Democrats to talk about corruption and hammer on Trump and do nothing else. They have to have a positive vision. I think they increasingly realize that and are beginning to talk about what that vision might be. But they have to have an offer that says, okay, those people are corrupt, but here's something that we can actually do. And that work has got to be done. So if anyone understands me as saying, talk about corruption and don't do any work on the positive message, that is not what I'm saying. But what I am saying is that for the next year and a half, when the entire government is in Republican hands, that means that the Democratic Party has an open runway. Absolutely everything that goes on until January of, what would that be, 2027, is their fault. The messaging, they're going to, hopefully they'll get their act together. They will find messages, they will find candidates, and that process will begin. But most of that process will begin in 2027 and 2028. So until then, what you need to do is chip away at his approval, get it down into the mid-30s and keep it there. The world is very different when Republicans are worried about losing elections because of the damage that Donald Trump and his MAGA movement are doing. They become less afraid of him, and the Democrats become less demoralized, and the public becomes more aware of what's really going on. It's not the solution to everything, but I think it's a big part of the tactical, strategic path forward for the next year and a half.
And the fact that Republicans have complete control of the House and Senate makes that much cleaner. It is difficult in our system when one party holds one branch and the other party holds another branch to say who's really responsible for the outcomes. In this case, there's no ambiguity about that.
Well, that's right. And, you know, I was just thinking earlier today, if I were the Democrats, I would be, we've got two vehicles coming up, which the president's going to have to sign. One is a continuing resolution, and another's a debt limit bill. Mm-hmm. And if I were the Democrats, I think I'd put together a People's Bill of Rights, I might call it. And it would be 5 or 10 amendments that would prohibit all kinds of things that the president was doing. And it would end the emergency authorities that he's using. Mm-hmm. And it would define as bribery, giving gifts and emoluments to the U.S. government. He can't pardon a Saudi prince. And then say, okay.
That may already be against the law, by the way.
A lot of it's against the law.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure that what he's done to the law firms would in normal times be prosecutable.
I meant the giving of gifts. There are laws about giving gifts.
Yeah.
And so the people who are donating to him may be in violation of laws. But anyway.
And of course, he decides which laws are enforced, which is the
point. That's true. Yes.
Nonetheless, the messaging that you could do by saying, okay, you want to pay the national debt? Why don't you sign off on some anti-corruption measures that we should all be able to agree? And throw in the ban on insider trading by members of, or I guess stock trading by members of Congress. Fry the Republicans on that one too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But this is another way to highlight these issues. And who knows, you might even be able to force the president to sign some of these things.
Okay, well...
I pushed too far there, didn't I?
Yeah, I'm skeptical about that last one, but but that's fine. Thank you so much, John, for coming on, and great discussion, and really something to think about.
Thanks. Just 3 words?
Go for it.
Most corrupt ever.
And they're true. They are as true as can be. I mean, the Gilded Age has nothing on Trump.
They were amateurs.
Indeed. Okay. Thanks, John Rauch.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.